Daily's edition of On Iowa Politics for Friday, July 31st, 2015. This week, debate season opens, the not-so-special session, and it's already getting hot in Iowa's 1st District. Hi, I'm James Lynch of the Sea Rapids Gazette. With me today are Aaron Murphy, Lee Newspaper State House Bureau Chief. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, James. Good to be here.
And Gazette columnist Todd Dorman. Hi, Todd.
Good morning.
You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe to On Iowa Politics on iTunes and Stitcher. First up, debate season starts. Even before Fox News winnows the GOP presidential field to the top 10, 14 Republicans who want to be president will gather in Manchester, New Hampshire Monday evening for the Voters First Forum, co-sponsored in part by the Gazette. Everyone but the Donald, Mike Ovendor Huckabee, and the late arriving Jim Gilmore will be there. Todd, even though Trump isn't on the stage, will he be on the stage? Should we expect a serious policy-oriented discussion of vital issues, or will this be an opportunity for the candidates to tee off on Trump?
Well, I suspect he might be hovering over the building in his enormous helicopter, maybe, if he's not on the stage. Yeah, you know, he's the national frontrunner, which I can't believe I'm saying, but he is. And so, of course, he's probably going to take some shots, but I mean, it seems to me that, you know, if you're another Republican running for president, you probably realize that, you know, Trump's kryptonite is probably substance. And so you may want to, you know, give your voters the Trump antidote, which would be telling people what you're actually going to do as president, maybe giving some plans, sharing some new ideas, because so far Trump isn't doing any of that. And we're sort of yet to hear whether he's going to transition from sort of the what's been the kind of media circus phase of his campaign into the sort of adult phase where he might actually share some ideas. Hasn't happened. But if I were one of the other candidates, I think I would, you know, that's what I would do, is perhaps give some substance and have the debate on the issues that you suggest might happen.
This forum is taking place on Monday night on August 6th. Is the Fox News debate. And like I said, it's going to be limited to the top 10 candidates in the field. And we've got several of these candidates sort of bunched at the bottom of preference polls. Pataki, Santorum, Fiorina, Warren, Jindal, Perry are at 2%. Christie's at 3%. Kasich and Cruz at 5%. So they're sort of bunched there. And I'm wondering, is this going to be sort of the race for 10th place where everybody is trying to say or do something memorable, so they're remembered the next day when the pollsters call and say, hey, who do you want? You know, if the election were today, who would you vote for? Should we expect, you know, the where's the beef line sorts of lines?
Well, I don't think, you know, I think, of course, you're going to try, every debate candidates try to sort of say something memorable or deliver a line that you know, makes the lead of news stories and news accounts the next day and gets people talking about their campaign. You know, but I don't think anybody's going to sort of, you know, if you're going to get into sort of a battle of saying outrageous things with Donald Trump, you're going to lose that battle. So if that's someone's objective, they're probably not going to do so hot. But again, as I said earlier, I think maybe, you know, we may see a swap in the narratives with these debates starting, where the media and others start saying, well, okay, we've seen the candidate who says the crazy things. Who's going to say the smart things now? Who's the adult in the room? And that may actually be how you grab some headlines, is if you strike people as being serious and having some ideas. Maybe I don't understand American politics anymore. And from what I've seen the last few weeks, maybe I don't. But that would seem to be a decent way to go at this point.
And Aaron, I think that sort of raises the question, how crazy is it here, you know, 6 months before the Iowa caucuses, more than a year before the election, to have a candidates debate where the invitations are based on popularity, basically, name recognition and popularity. Is this a good way to run an election or run a campaign?
It's interesting. We're living in a new world of campaigns. And then the 16, 17, however you want to candidate field, I think is partially a result of that. So we're kind of in new waters here. I think we're all, the candidates, the media, the voters, I think we're all trying to figure this out together. You've got with the in particular the Citizens United ruling that created the influx of money into campaigns. You've got single donors that can keep a candidate alive for as long as they want. So, I think we're in uncharted waters here, and we're all figuring this out together. And I don't think there is a template for how to run a campaign in a 16-17-way primary. So who knows what works and what doesn't? I guess we'll find out over the next few months.
But does it make sense that, say, Donald Trump and Ben Carson, two guys who I think you can legitimately say are outstanding in their field but have no experience in governing, are in the debate, but George Pataki, who was a successful governor, Bobby Jindal, successful governor, these folks might be watching from home. I mean, does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense in this way, is that, and I think we've talked about this when we talked about Trump in the past, is the kind of people, supporters he has tapped into are those who are just sick of government every which way but loose. From that standpoint, to see him and Carson, who, along with Fiorina, and I apologize if I'm missing someone, that's about it as far as anybody who has not been an elected official in this field. But from that standpoint, that anti-Washington, anti-government sentiment has really seems to have peaked in this election, and in particular in this Republican primary. So from that standpoint, it's not altogether surprising. I can discuss a lot of scenarios in which it is surprising, but for that specific reason, it's not.
No, I was going to say I agree with Aaron. I mean, we've seen politics. I mean, we've got largely big money, substance-free politics, so I don't think it's any surprise that we have a big money, substance-free front runner. I mean, this is where we've been going. So Donald Trump is the personification of our political dreams. Not exactly.
Looking at the calendar, we really should be talking about the Iowa straw poll this week. But there is not going to be an Iowa straw poll. And I guess given what we've just been talking about, Todd, does this make you more in the passing of the Iowa straw poll?
Yeah, I think this weekend I'm going to do some barbecue and cast some fake ballots at in my backyard, just in commemoration of the straw poll.
Oh, you know, it's
it's kind of interesting if you think about it. I mean, back a few months ago when this was being hashed out, it was Ben Carson and Donald Trump who were the only ones who had sort of committed to coming. And you sort of wonder if Republicans had seen the way this was going to play out, that they might have held on a little bit longer, because Trump got pretty hot. And that could have been an interesting event. It could have been a big sort of the Trump state fair. But it's gone, and it's not coming back, I don't think. But, I mean, I've heard people say that maybe these debates – are going to be the sort of winnowing event that the straw poll has, that purpose that it served. I don't know. As Aaron mentioned, you know, when you've got super PACs and entities that are keeping candidates alive indefinitely, I don't know how the field gets winnowed, honestly. The caucuses may do some of that, but which traditionally has been the case. But who knows? It is sort of a new paradigm we're experiencing.
But I'm wondering if a candidate – isn't in the top 10, doesn't get on that stage, how do they go to their financial backers and say, hey, I'm a legitimate candidate, I still have a shot? How long, either Aaron or Todd, how long will people keep spending money on a candidate who can't even get on the stage?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I guess, it's a new world. I guess we'll find out. Those donor candidate connections are important for so many reasons, and this year maybe even more so. So if you've got someone who's going to back you no matter what, then you're in good shape. But if you need to give them something tangible, then yeah, those ones who aren't on the stage for that debate are going to be in trouble. I don't know, Todd, if you had any further thoughts
on
that.
I think you do have a group of candidates probably at the bottom of the pack that it won't be too long before it basically reality settles in that it's not going to work for them. The trouble is you've got, easily 10, 12 candidates who could claim in various ways that they've actually got some sort of shot, or at least a resume that should make them, you know, someone that should be in the serious conversation. So that's sort of the group that's going to be tough to winnow, sort of the folks who basically have backers, have some monetary, you know, some fundraising behind them, and who think in this field if somebody stumbles and if things sort of get shaken up that they could rise. I mean, there's a lot of folks with that scenario in their head, and it's going to be tough to convince them that it's not going to happen.
Before we leave the topic of debates, I just want to ask you about the Fox News debate. It is the first time all these candidates will be on stage together. I mean, they've appeared at a number of forums and summits and where they've spoken one at a time or been interviewed one at a time. Todd, you touched on this kind of, you know, the idea that substance might be the anti-Trump tactic here. Do you expect that the other nine are going to press Trump on how he's going to make America great? You know, what are some of the specifics of how he's going to do that?
Yeah, I think
or
so. No, I think they will. I mean, I think we heard him talk about, you know, he's going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something terrific, which I think Ryan Lizza of the New Yorker dubbed that Terrificare. Which, I mean, I think that's what you do is you say, okay, you've said this, you've said that, you've talked about immigration, you've talked about how they're criminals and drug dealers and rapists. Well, what would you do besides build a giant wall to stop that? I mean, what are the details of your agenda? What would you do if you're president? I mean, it's not just about campaigning and insulting and saying outrageous things. You have to tell us what you do. I mean, that is sort of the anti-Trump argument, is that he's certainly is sort of stoking some populist resentment and some anger out there. But after you do that, what do you do?
Well, after the Iowa legislature finally reached a compromise on school funding and keeping mental health institutes open and a variety of other things, the governor took it upon himself to veto those funds and give everyone heartburn and indigestion and create great consternation in the education community. And while there was really nothing special about the 2015 session, these vetoes seem to leave a lot of problems, especially for K-12 schools. Aaron, you covered the session. Any thoughts on why Republicans didn't want a special session to override those funds that they voted for?
Yeah, it's interesting, and I'll provide the caveat that I haven't had a chance to talk to any legislators since this in the last week or so. So I'm just kind of speculating here, but I think there is a partisan unity at play here. I think obviously the state house Republicans who signed off on the agreement, and not all of them did, but enough did to get it passed. I think the ones who did were fine with it. But I also think most of them, and we've seen that now, would have been fine had the veto come down as it is. I think they were fine approving it. I don't think they were losing over sleep over whether the governor ultimately was going to sign off on it. I think to a lot of Republicans, they saw this as a compromise to get the two sides of the two chambers, the two parties, to agree to something to send to the governor so they could complete their session, complete their work. I really don't think most of them saw that extra $56 million for the schools, the extra money to keep the NHIs operating a little longer. I don't think they saw those as particularly make or break for them. So when the calls for an override came, I was skeptical, and I'm not surprised at all that that there weren't the votes there to support that. I just don't think they felt strongly about those issues enough to mount a veto effort.
Todd, yesterday Speaker Craig Paulson, Republican from Hiawatha, said he expects to pick up seats in the 2016 election and that Republicans will take control of the Senate, where Democrats outnumber them 26 to 24 right now. Given this scenario, the way this session played out, the governor's override, Republicans' refusal to come back in special session to override that, does that seem like a good strategy for gaining seats in the next election?
Yeah, I think the governor made their road tougher. I mean, I think he's handed a fairly volatile weapon to the Democrats. I think, you know, they've been tweeting like mad about all the millions of dollars that Senate districts and House districts lost through the governor's veto, with a picture of the Republican lawmaker they say is responsible because they didn't come back and override the veto. I mean, the governor has sort of energized some core Democratic constituencies. The, you know, Senator Johnson's admonition that the teachers quit whining, I think we'll see that come back in some ads. But, you know, a lot will depend on how Republicans respond to this in the 2016 legislative session. Will they be willing to maybe put some more money into education and basically forge some sort of deal that the governor agrees to ahead of time, or how will it play out? Or will we get this sort of stalemate again and sort of forge a deal that, you know, we don't know what the governor will do and the trust is broken down? So, I mean, the next legislative session will make a big difference. But if all things remain constant, I think the governor vetoing that education money, closing those mental health facilities, I think he's handed the Democrats a fairly good election year issue.
Yeah, I agree with that, and especially as Todd, you mentioned the session in between. I mean, it's a long way until November 2016, and you'll have a whole, you know, five, God help us, 6 month session between now and then, and that could, and I would almost say likely will, wipe away any memory voters have of the 2015 session. So much hinges upon what happens next year. And to that extent, what happens will depend on how the Iowa economy is doing. If we have a good year and there's enough money, then maybe there's enough to put in education without a big fight. So much depends on what happens next year. And then there's also the one thing I will say is I think it needs to be seen whether education is a voting issue, whether it's something that motivates enough people at the polls to swing some of those seats. And the other thing I'll just add to that, to put a quick button on it, is while I understand Speaker Paulson's efforts, and of course he's going to do what he can to flip that Senate, and likewise so Senate Republicans, if they couldn't get it done in 2014, which we saw what happened for Republicans in that election, they went in 26-24, they came out 26-4. How are they going to be able to do that in a presidential election year that tends to swing the electorate a little more Democratic, I think there's a big challenge for them to pull that off.
Well, and the problem for House Republicans now is that, you know, even if they offer what they would consider a decent deal, there isn't a lot of incentive for Senate Democrats to take much of a deal. There's sort of blood in the water on this issue, and their position, you know, will be to hold out, and if they can't get what they want, to go to the campaign trail with it. I mean, the odds of a grand education bargain that satisfies everybody are probably fairly low now, but you know, it depends. It also depends on whether the education debate opens up and you've got Republican lawmakers sort of talking about vouchers and privatizing, you know, parts of the public school system. That's where you might get into a scenario where people suddenly maybe don't like what they're hearing and vote education. If it's just about money, Aaron's right. I don't know how far that goes with the electorate, but I guess, you know, we'll see how it unfolds.
We did hear some Republicans, Bobby Kaufman from Wilton, talking about starting the session with Republicans should say 3% increase in education funding, that, you know, as a starting point, which strikes me as probably a non-starter among the Republican caucus to agree to a 3% increase for the next 2 years. But you know, there is a minority in the House Republican Caucus who wants to increase education funding, and we're not happy with the agreement that they were stuck with, I guess, at the end of the session. So there's some seeds of discontent there. Moving on quickly, we'll talk about the first district race, where things seem to be heating up rather quickly. I don't know if this is political climate warming there, but this race looked like it wasn't going to be much of a race. Monica Vernon jumped in early. She had a lot of money. She had a lot of endorsements and seemed to have the nomination sewn up. And then Pat Murphy jumped into the race and said he's going to give it another shot. And already it appears that this race is going to get nasty with MLA's list, which has endorsed Vernon, says Murphy isn't pro-choice enough, it's pro-family enough. So he released a record showing how his voting pattern has shifted from pro-life to pro-choice. MLA's list said he omitted a few things from that record. So Murphy countered by releasing a record of all his political contributions. And Aaron, you've covered Murphy in the past. Was this about showing Democratic primary voters that he's a regular middle-class guy making small-dollar contributions to his fellow Democrats? Or is this the born-a-Democrat Murphy challenging Vernon, born-a-Republican, now a Democrat, to list all of her contributions over the years and so people can see how many Republicans she supported?
See all of the above.
Okay.
There's no doubt that those are two messages. I think it's safe to say you're going to hear from Pat Murphy in this campaign is I'm the middle class guy. I'm the guy who's been fighting for the middle class. And then I have no doubt that he will push the narrative that he is. I think I've heard him say, use the word the only real progressive in this race. As you noted, kind of intentionally drawing some interest to Monica Vernon's past, her history as being a Republican at one point. You're right. It has gotten pretty active pretty quickly here. And I don't know if part of that is, you know, Pat Murphy commissioned that poll that showed he would lead coming into the race, but I almost have to wonder if he feels like a little bit of an underdog coming into this race, despite those numbers, just given the work that Monica Vernon has already done, fundraising and securing a lot of not just endorsements, but key endorsements for as much as they may carry weight with voters. Clearly, Pat Murphy has jumped into this race fairly aggressively. And to be fair, Monica Vernon's campaign has responded just as aggressively. So I think we're in for a primary campaign here. This isn't going to be a quiet one.
The other line I've heard a number of times from Pat Murphy already is that he tries to say that unlike other candidates, he can't self-fund, which again casts him as sort of the regular middle-class average Joe sort of guy. Well, that's it for this edition of On Iowa Politics. I hope it was worth your time. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, tell a friend and subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Fan mail may be sent to oniowapolitics@gmail.com. You can find us every week on the homepages of the Quad City Times, Sioux City Journal, Muscatine Journal, Mason City Globe Gazette, Waterloo Courier, and the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Jordan Bergren from Cedar Rapids will take us out. If you know a band or a talented Iowa musician who should be on our show, send us a sound file. And remember to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to On Iowa Politics on iTunes and Stitcher. For Aaron, Todd, and our producer, Claire, I'm James Lynch. Thanks for listening. If this girl's a devil, Lord, she's gotta be one hell of a beast. I think I'm gonna overboard when I tell my mom my license. And the thing that separates us from the wild is set as the cornerstone, leaving gravity on before the throne inside. Stone, leaving gravity only for the throne inside.